ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I started to become uncomfortable or disillusioned with the promises of documentary after I made my first documentary. Hi, my name is Jess Shane. I'm an artist and radio producer based in Brooklyn, but from Toronto.
And before Jess was a documentary maker, she worked in what she calls community arts.
Working and doing art workshops with people in different sort of community spaces, making art with them and about them and for them. And so for a few years, at the end of my undergraduate degree, I was working in this organization that was a food bank. It offered social services, it offered art workshops, and it just was so meaningful to the people involved. But I always felt like I needed to get some more hard skills for my future life. And I was like, well, I really love this work of storytelling together. That's what radio and podcasting does, doesn't it?
But after making her first audio documentary, Jess experienced a bit of an ethical quandary. The piece was about her childhood neighbour, who was a teenager at the time.
I was just like, it's going to be fine because once I make it, she'll see the beautiful art that I've made and it will be great. And so I sent it to her and I didn't hear back from her. Instead, I got a call from her mom saying, Nicola really hates what you made and she's very upset. She feels very hurt. And then we didn't talk for years. I really think the ghost of that experience really lived with me.
We'll come back to Jess and what she's tried to change about her practice since that experience. But her story raises the question, what is an ethical job?
Wow, great question. Let me just think about this for a second.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and in this episode of This Working Life, ethics and your work. How can we build an ethical career, and why does it matter?
So I think, why do we work? A lot of the times, we do it for the wrong reasons.
Ethical mirage, what it really is referring to is this idea that people predict that they will behave more ethically than they actually do.
But yet we are guided by these unknown forces that are beyond our view, then we lose control and we act in ways that go against what we really believe is right. So understanding these things gives us a little bit of control.
That's Dr. Tim Dean.
I am the senior philosopher at the Ethics Centre, and I hold the Manos Chair in Ethics.
There was a pivotal moment, I think, just over a decade ago when you gave up your managing editor role in publishing to do a PhD in philosophy. That could have been a very scary moment, a very big decision. So how did you go about making that choice?
Yeah, it was a big choice. I think slowly is the way I went about it, because there were all of these narratives around what's expected of me as a person, as a worker, as a you know, middle-aged white guy, you know, this career path and the success. And what you do is you go up into management and you make more money and you, I don't know, buy a house and get a dog or something, whatever that story is. Never really appealed to me, but of course that story is always lurking in the background. And then there are things like the price of houses and stuff is like, geez, I've got this momentum pushing me down this particular career path. And it takes a lot of will to step off that ladder. But I had a couple of things that really shaped my thinking. One is just my passion for philosophy and my confidence that there was a latent demand. There was a demand for public philosophy that just wasn't being satisfied.
So, which takes us to philosophy and work, whether it be making these decisions about right and wrong ethics at work. But I also want to go up a level and ask, why do we actually work?
I love that question. It's such a pertinent question these days because with all the talk about like AI tech bros and things, do we need to work? Should we be going to a four-day week? You know, what is it all for? We go back to Marx and alienation. There's so much in there. Why do we work? Now, so there's something really interesting about applying yourself to the world to do something, to change something, to do something meaningful. We work, we expend effort to do something that we think is important or meaningful. Now, that's the basic idea of work, but then we bring it into a capitalist economy And we have to factor in this other filter thing of like, what is going to generate enough wealth such that someone's going to pay me for it, either through the products that I produce or through the labor that I contribute or whatever that might be. So why do we work there is instead of the effort to kind of directly get food or whatever, we do it mediated through the economy. But the problem with that thinking is capitalism gives us a proxy of value, which is money. It's only a proxy because it's only instrumentally good. We only value money because it enables us to do other things. But instead of chasing other things and then just getting enough money to do those things, it's really easy to start just chasing money. And with that, we start chasing status and authority and reputation and these intangible goods. And these are all proxies for what we think is important. We work because of fear. We work because we think we should. We work because we believe that there's dignity in labor. But when you're a worker in a large organization, that could be a factory, it could be an office, you are just doing this tiny little bit of work and you're detached from why you're doing it and you're detached from the impact that it has on the world and you're alienated. And so you try to find your sense of agency elsewhere and you get office politics, you get status games, you get all this other kind of crap that goes around. So I think why do we work? A lot of the times we do it for the wrong reasons.
So that takes us to this idea, the modern idea of success. What can you say about our current opinions about what makes a person successful, Tim?
Success is such a nebulous idea. So how do we know what success looks like? And interestingly, even our distant ancestors asked the same question. They said, what does success look like? Who should I be more like? Who should I emulate? And we actually evolved. Our minds evolved to be incredibly sensitive to the cues of success in other people. And we would be drawn to them and we would try to mimic and emulate them. When we look at people we perceive to be successful today, we're drawn to all of the outward characteristics of what that success looks like and we seek to emulate that. And often that can be a distraction. Again, it's the proxy problem. There's something deeper that we think might be important or valuable, but it's obscured from view. So we just look at the proxies, the veneer. We look at status. We look at beauty. We look at wealth. We look at these aspects of their personality that we think that's what success looks like. But we often get distracted. And so instead of asking yourself, what do I want to look like? You say, what are the processes that I enjoy? Do I want to be with people? Do I want to lead? Do I want to follow? Do I want to solve problems? Do I want to be reactive, proactive? Do I want to use my hands? Do I want to use my mind? Those kinds of questions, if you get a good idea about them, and you're not going to get a good idea about them until you've tried all of those things and failed at some and been successful at others, it could take 10 years. When you've tried those things, I think then you can start to have your own idea of what success looks like in terms of a deeper sense of meaning and fulfillment and mastery, something that you are good at, and then hopefully find someone who can pay you for it.
Okay, so if you want to work somewhere you align with ethically, it's a good idea to identify your values. We've recently done an episode on values in our work. We'll link to it in the show notes. But once we're in a job, how can we ensure we're behaving ethically day to day?
Good question. Most of us think of ourselves as good ethical people. We aspire to be good at work and in our lives broadly. But there is a lot of evidence that good people do bad things.
That's Mariam Kachaki.
I'm a professor of management and organization at Kellogg School of Management, Northwestern University. I've been studying morality and ethics in the workplace for over 15 years now. And on the basis of my own research and others, I believe that there is need for us to take charge to actually develop ethical careers.
And developing an ethical career is not a set and forget. It's a daily practice.
If we can consistently be ethical, make the right decisions, you know, avoid doing bad, but more importantly, doing good. I think that's what I mean by ethical careers, for us to take charge to develop ethical careers and be good people.
And why are our good intentions not enough, Mariam?
I think the reason our good intentions aren't enough is that there is a lot that happens beyond our control. What I mean is that even though we hope to be ethical and we inspire to be ethical, but there is a lot of evidence showing that it's more than about just deciding in the moment what to do. There is a lot of factors such as, for example, time pressure, conflict of interest, the self-deception and rationalization that we are good at. I think there are a lot of situational psychological reasons that well-intentioned people stumble on their path to really being good or to the moral excellence they inspire.
So shifting our mindset can help us do the right thing professionally, you have found in your research. So tell me what moral humility is.
So we are all imperfect and we are all morally fallible, and we tend to overestimate our ability to make good choices and overcome temptations. So for us to become our best moral selves and build an ethical career, intentional ethical career, it requires an acknowledgement that our moral character is malleable, that if we don't proactively try to shape our life, external forces are likely to twist us in uncomfortable ways. So having moral humility means acknowledging our shortcomings, which is the first step to moral growth, to ethical learning, really pursuing this lifelong journey of getting better, being intentional and doing better.
I love this. And in fact, one term that I think is great is the idea of an ethical mirage. What is this?
So I think ethical mirage, what it really is referring to is this idea that people predict that they will behave more ethically than they actually do. And when we evaluate our past behaviors, the same, we believe the way we behaved is more ethically what we actually did. And in my own research, I find evidence for what we call ethical obfuscation. What we find is that people actually forget their misdeeds more than other things that they've done before. So again, there's a lot of psychology that because of the defensive mechanisms that we have, we tend to really overestimate our good behaviors and our underestimates, and to some extent even forget the bad things that we've done before.
So how do we counteract the mirage and develop moral humility then?
I think there are different things we can do. In my work, we talk about a three-stage process where we want to really focus on how we can plan for the challenges in front of us. So one of the best strategies is if-then planning. And dozens of studies shown this practice of, for us, saying if X happens, then I'll do this, correct, do Y. I think that is very effective in changing people's behaviors. And importantly, we need to basically be detailed, because sometimes we say, you know, if my boss says this, I'll just, resist, I don't do what he's asking for. But you need to do more detailed planning. What would you actually say? I think the example for me, a lot of them, is that we almost all of us would say, if I witness sexual harassment, racial prejudice, something like that, I would immediately stand up, I think, for the victim or for myself or for women. But I've been in enough of these situations. It's hard in the moments. And then in the moment, how we can really live up to those values, the values that we have. And then after the fact, how we can basically reflect.
But even with that three-stage process of preparing, making good decisions and reflecting, we can still fall into the trap of self-deceptive rationalizations. So how do we avoid that trap? Mariam has some tips.
Asking yourself the right questions, I think that could help us avoid these self-deceptive rationalizations. Myself, when I'm in these situations, I usually, the first question I ask myself is the mirror test. Would I like the person that I see in the mirror after making this decision? I think that's really important for me. Is that the person that I really want to be? I think the other one is generalizability test. Would I be comfortable having my decision serve as a precedent for all other decisions, other people following through and making the same decision? And the last one, publicity test. How would I feel? Would I feel comfortable if my choice, my action, is published on the front page of the local newspaper or maybe right now social media or other places? I think that's really important as well. I think these tests push us to be more reflective, to think about what we are doing and the implication for ourselves and, more importantly, for other people. and for our reputation.
Now, when it comes to protecting our reputation, Mariam says it's important to distinguish between your resume virtues and your eulogy virtues.
I think the distinction is, I think what David Brooks in his book, The Road to Character, I think he distinguishes between resume virtues, which are about skills, abilities, accomplishment that we have, versus eulogy virtues, which are things that people praise us after we've died. And I think what really is important here is that we should ask ourselves, what are our eulogy virtues, you know, the things that we are trying to develop, and framing our professional and personal life as a quest for contribution, correct, the impact on other people's lives rather than just achievement. I mean, a lot of us really focus on, unfortunately, on what he calls resume virtues, correct, our accomplishment rather than focusing on our eulogy virtues.
Well, our values inform all of our ethical decisions.
Tim Dean again from the Ethics Centre in Melbourne.
Our values about what we think is good and bad in the world, as well as our principles. The principles are like the rules that we adhere to, like maybe the golden rule or rules that we should always respect other people's dignity or something like that. Those values and those principles, we use them, we have them. We often don't articulate them, but by understanding them, we have a better chance of making a better decision. It's central to the ethical kind of project.
What if my core value is hedonism?
Well, then that's a core value. And we will question, we'll encourage you to question where those values come from and whether they really genuinely satisfy you. But if you have a really good reason to support hedonism, then that's the value that is going to guide you. Hedonism, this idea of pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain, there are a lot of philosophers who have promoted that idea. There are modern philosophers like, you know, Peter Singer, who pursues that kind of idea. There are ancient philosophers like Epicurus who promoted hedonism of a sort. He was more about avoiding pain than chasing pleasure. But there are lots of different ways to cash it out. If your value is, I want to chase pleasure and I don't give a damn about other people that I hurt, well, then we'll encourage you to reflect upon whether that is ethical. Now, we're not here to give a black and white rendering of ethics, but we will interrogate to help you understand what is right and what kinds of responsibilities that you have.
My value isn't really hedonism, by the way. Anymore it was, but not anymore. Just so that you know. And by the way, when Tim was saying we just then, he was referring to Ethical, the Ethics Centre free independent helpline where you can get advice on any ethical issues. And they get a lot of work-related ethical questions.
Well, we get questions around perceived unfairness or misconduct. We get questions around whether someone should take a particular job. So quite a common question, this comes up quite a lot in a lot of contexts, is someone is offered a well-paying job in an industry that they're not particularly in tune with or they don't believe is ethical, compared to a lower-paying job in an industry or in a job that they find really meaningful.
What sort of questions are useful with that type of issue then? Should I take this job or not? It pays really well, but maybe it's not in the industry that I, you know, am passionate about.
Well, look, there are a lot of different concerns there. One of those is to go back to values. What do you really care about? How much are you earning? Are you safe and secure? Are you looking after your just material concerns? Do you have other people who depend upon you? Because the luxury of making a choice to take a lower paying job and a lower standard of living in terms of monetary terms, that's fine for an individual. But if you're looking after, if you have dependents, you have other responsibilities as well. We ask questions about, you know, what's the impact? What's the outcome on the world? If you think that this organization is not doing the right thing, could your influence within that organization change that around? Could you make that organization be better? That's a more kind of consequentialist ethical point of view. You can think about things like your duties. What kinds of duties do you have to people around you, to your particular workplace? Have you made commitments? There's all sorts of different factors that can come into it. It really depends on individual circumstances, and it depends on the caller's values. We do not tell the caller which framework is the best or the right one to apply or which values to adopt. We try to let them get in touch with their own values and make a decision that accords with what they already think is important.
Let's return now to Jess Shane, the audio producer in America who tried to make a more ethical documentary podcast. So she had three rules to guide her.
that would help me unpack for an audience the transactionality that I saw was the unspoken heart of so much storytelling that was happening. The first thing that I thought of was oftentimes when people in our industry tend to talk about documentary ethics, they talk about how maybe the participants or maybe the subject should be paid. We're not talking about like news, but we're talking about like turning people's lives into products, which is happening now more than ever with the rise of streaming, you know, and the popularity of documentary or reality nonfiction content. And so a lot of people are like, well, you should just pay people, at least, you know, pay them for their time. Personally, I've never seen a problem with that. But I also don't think that that's an answer because it doesn't really account for the fact that there's already this assumed exchange that's happening that I always felt and then increasingly was uncomfortable with that I was tapping into. Like people who feel like they want to be famous, people who feel like they need therapy and can't afford therapy and want somebody to listen to them. People who feel like really unseen or discriminated against in the world and feel that telling their story is the only way to make people less shitty. Am I allowed to say shitty on the ABC?
Sure, you can say shitty. So Jess paid her guests for their time and she was transparent with them while making the podcast, asking for their feedback and input on the edits and the scripting. But did the experiment work? Did she feel like a more ethical documentary maker?
I think the experiment didn't work, and kind of what I wanted to show was that you can't just like change these little surface level rules and hope that like a systemic dynamic is solved. But I think that like you can't say, oh, I'm going to collaborate, but still be on a deadline, still have limited money, still be the one person that's calling all the shots. And the thing that I've realized is that it's not going to be fair.
But it should be truthful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's truthful to say it's not going to be fair because I'm in charge. And I think that I deluded myself and maybe also deluded you by letting you feel that we were doing this really together and that we were collaborating when ultimately, like, I'm going to publish this now.
This is the conceit of narrative, that the story can be finished. Of course, Judy's story isn't finished.
No, but the product, ongoing, yeah.
But here, I'm the one who gets to decide where it ends.
So me, the producer, thought that, like, the limitations of the rules would reveal themselves through the earnest attempt to follow them.
But of course, Jess isn't alone in feeling this way.
Well, don't we all hold many things? We all have to work jobs often that we don't fully politically, ethically agree with because we have to pay our rents. You know, I think that like the thing that I was grappling with in the series is that I set out all these big highfalutin ideals about what I think documentary should be and what it shouldn't be. But at the end of the day, I had a limited budget and limited time and a contract. And so that's what I mean when I say like you can't change the rules within the confines of a system that has stayed the same.
Thanks to my guests, artist and radio producer Jess Shane, Mariam Kuchaki, Professor of Management and Organisations at the Kellogg School of Management, and Dr. Tim Dean, Senior Philosopher at the Ethics Centre in Melbourne. I'm Lisa Leong. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It's produced by Zoe Ferguson and it's mixed by Brendan O'Neill. Next time on This Working Life, when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a fireman. Dashing off to the scene of a fire and trying to be the hero. So that's what I was consciously aware of when I was a little kid. You know, through my studies at INSEAD, I had the opportunity to explore perhaps some unconscious associations that I hadn't previously known associated to being a fireman. These unconscious kind of associations or forces, they're almost like hibernating bears. They lurk in our psyche and our unconscious, and they awaken when they're not being nourished or fed, and that they can actually influence our sense of satisfaction and our career choices.
Don't miss out. If you enjoyed this episode, you'll probably enjoy another one we did last year about why good people do bad things. You can find it in our show notes. This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Until next time, work it, baby.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.